I thought we would just talk rather informally this time, because the last time you were in, I traced your life. I remember you told me, and it was so vivid I remember it. You were in the Philippines, and you saw a delicate film of dust on the leaves and the grass at the side of the road, and you thought to yourself, somebody should write about that. And then you said, no, I'm going to write about that. And that's exactly
yeah,
what you
that's
did.
Right, yeah.
And so we covered a lot of the early beginnings, the things that shaped you as a poet. I want to kind of get caught up a little bit about some of the things you've done since 1981, and but I also want to go back a little ways, because I know that you played football at Clemson. And
one season.
What's that?
One season, yeah.
Well, and did you also play at Vanderbilt?
No, I was ineligible because I hadn't played at Clemson.
Yeah. You were an athletic person. And
yeah, that was my whole life, really, up until the time I went into the service.
I'd like to know a little bit about how an athlete reconciles his love for art and literature and music. Now, I know this sounds like an odd question, but sometimes I listen to sportscast of college athletes, and many of them seem extremely inarticulate. I know that in my own alma mater, they go out of the way to try to find scholarships for athletes, not because they are qualified academically, but because they're good for the football team. And I wonder a little bit about this. You developed into an extremely sensitive poet, and yet you sprang from a background of athletics.
Well, they're really not all that contradictory. I mean, the reason that a lot of athletes seem inarticulate is because I think really offhand, however, that they're not so much now as they used to be. But one of the reasons, if that's true, that they are now, is that their education is subordinated to athletics. I mean, football is, to take that sport, is so incredibly complicated now. The plays and so on, everything is computerized. Every player is graded on every game, and not only on every game, but every practice. And so on, and he's got to function just so in the machine of the victory-making football enterprise, you know, and it's they haven't any time to do anything but that. I mean, they take courses, and some of them struggle along, and they do pretty well, but it's against an enormous current of the athletic endeavor that they've set themselves to do, and the others have set them to do. So it doesn't bother me that they don't all talk like Bill Buckley or something. They can't, but there's some exceptions to that. I mean, people who can go against that grain and are outstanding athletes and do go on. I see that Bill Bradley, the ex-Princeton basketball player and ex-Knicks basketball player and current senator from New Jersey, is now one of the front-running candidates for the presidential nomination in 88.
Yeah, there's Jack Kemp up in
Jack
Buffalo.
Kemp is another one, hardly in that class, but he just done all right, too.
Let's go back further than Clemson. You grew up in rural Georgia.
Well, in Atlanta, around Atlanta, north of Atlanta. I come from Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. What sort of early encouragement did you have from your parents in your early schooling to become a writer?
Not really very much. My mother was an invalid or semi-invalid, and she liked to read, but mostly listened to the radio and talk over the phone to relatives. And my father was a lawyer whose main interest in the law was essentially in the forensic rhetoric of famous barristers like Clarence Darrow and Robert Ingersoll. And he used to read famous trials to me from a big bookcase of trial transcripts he had called Classics of the Bar. I suppose that really was my first impetus in the direction of any kind of use of language. A specialized use of language would be that. He read me trial after trial, but he liked the closing statements the best, because that gave the lawyer a chance to do his stuff rhetorically. And we went over some of those over and over and over Ingersoll, and especially over Darrow. who was a great idol of my father's. My father went up to the Dayton, the Tennessee Scopes trial just to see him do his stuff because my father disliked Bryan, William Jennings Bryan, and liked Darrow very much. And he said, oh my, when he put Bryan on the stand, it was no contest.
I'm sure it wasn't. I have this theory that so much of what we do is an accident of life.
I do too. I believe that.
Yeah. Well, you started out, you were in athletics. You went into the Air Force. Air Force, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, I was in the Air Force.
And out of the Air Force, it was back into college. You became an advertising person. You were even on welfare at some point.
Yes, I was. Yeah.
Your life has been so varied and so mixed that it seemed that odd that things fell in place for you in the way that they have.
Well, I don't know that they really are in place to any great extent, but I had one principle ever since I began to write that was unvarying no matter what I did, whether I was in the Air Force or whether I was going to college or whether I was teaching freshman English someplace or whether I was in advertising, working for Coca-Cola or for Armour Fertilizer or for Delta Airlines in advertising or on some kind of fellowship or foundation grant or teaching creative writing or lecturing or whatever I did, I had one unwavering principle that governed and dictated everything that I did, and that was the determination to live by means of the word, of language, and mainly in the most refined and difficult and important use of it, which is poetry, and that was going to be it for me. I knew when I first actually started to practice it, even at a very, very humble level indeed, I knew, I said to myself, something inside me said, this is for me. This is what I want to do. So I've never varied from the kind of temperament I have, if such it could be called, is that if I really truly love something or an activity or something, some person or some pursuit that I happen to start to follow, it has the capacity never to tire me or to bore me. I've read hundreds of thousands of poems in lots of different languages and so on, and I've written a good many and so on, and I have notes for hundreds more. But the subject never bores me. I can sit down and work on poetry all day long. If I could sleep, go without sleep, I could work on poems 24 hours every day. I can't do that. Of course, I have other demands made on me and other duties and so on, so I can't do that. But there's not anything I'd rather do than sit down with a piece of paper and try to work out some kind of interesting sequence of rhythms or images or some depiction of some sort of an event from a certain slant or point of view in some way.
I was talking to Robert Creeley not too long ago. He was here in New York, and I had complained to him that there is so much in the poetry that I read that I don't understand. I can read a line and read a line and then reread it, and sometimes I don't understand.
There's a lot that I don't understand either, and some of it I write.
But he says that doesn't matter to him, because you can usually feel the nuance of...
Well, I think ultimately it does matter, but it can matter on different levels. Creeley's own work I'm rather fond of, but his whole orientation toward, this is what I suppose you would call the life of poetry, since you seem to like to talk about that part of it, is quite different from mine. He's essentially a group man, the Black Mountain poets, and he's sort of on the periphery of the hippies, and had lots of friends who write poetry, and have the same intentions as he has, and the same principles, and he was a great friend of Charles Olson, who was a sort of a guru of those folks. And so, and he's always been in that part of, I've been in poetry from the standpoint of belonging to a movement of some sort. I'm a complete loner. and I don't know what you call it, outsider, a guerrilla fighter.
Well, I chastised Creeley. He had written some poems that, so sure, I think his shortest poem, and I can quote it to you directly, it's called It, It. And I said, what?
What?
How can a person be expected to understand what you're saying? He says, God knows, thank God I don't have to tell anybody.
Yeah.
And I kind of wondered about little lines like that, which are so elusive.
You secretly think to yourself, could he tell anybody? Is it possible?
It meant something to him at the
time. Yeah, well, I mean, you can fool yourself about that, though. I mean, there's a very dangerous thing for poets, especially some poets who work near the line between, that runs between intelligibility and unintelligibility, whether you say something that sounds good to you and you like it, you don't have any, you couldn't say exactly why, but you feel like you want to stay with it, and it's easy to persuade yourself not only that you like it, but you don't know quite what it means. It's easy to persuade yourself that it means something important because you like it, and it's that would be enough certification. But I think you have to watch out there. I think it's self-delusion is very easy when you get over into that area.
Now, wait a minute. Just a moment ago, you said that sometimes you were unsure of some of the meanings in your
book. I am, and I go with them for that reason, and that's why I know, and that's how I know. And so, and I try to keep that to a minimum. But if I have a line and so on that I'm not sure would come across to a member of any conceivable real or theoretical audience, but it seems to me to carry some overtone that I can't quite myself grasp. I will generally go with it. And I'm sure Creeley was talking about something like that. I think most poets will do that.
You have been teaching at the University of South Carolina for some years now, is that correct?
Yes, I have been there, attached to the staff there for... This is my 17th year.
Are you teaching creative writing and poetry?
Yeah, I teach a course called verse composition. I deliberately keep the word poetry out of anything that has to do with the workshop class, so that's when people actually try to write it. Because you can teach verse, there are rules from that, like there are rules for plain geometry that you can establish in the student's mind and his memory, and one hopes that... Notice I didn't say hopefully. Well, there are rules, and you can teach that. But poetry is something that is indefinable, that sometimes is said within verse and by means of verse, and sometimes not. The best of it is said within a verse medium of some kind, but the poetic imagination or the poetic grasp of a situation and projection of a situation is not by any means limited to what is written in verse or what is written in formal and metered, structures at all. I mean, this is where it's confounding. As Mr. T.S. Eliot said, there is a workable definition or by means of which one can distinguish verse from prose. That is, verse operates according to some recurring system of stresses of accented and unaccented syllables. That is, something deliberately manipulated on that basis, whereas prose has its own rhythm, but it doesn't have a regular or recurring motif. This is so you can distinguish prose from verse, but there's no corresponding distinction between verse and poetry, because a lot of poetry is written in verse, but there's a great deal of verse which does not rise to the level of poetry, but is in meter, and so on. And so it gets kind of confusing. The best displays of poetic insight a writer like Herman Melville are not in his rather labored, versified depictions of events and so on, but in the prose of Moby Dick in some parts of the shorter pieces like the Incantatas and so on. So you get his best poetic punch in prose, and when he tries to reduce it to verse, or tries to get it into verse, it doesn't work out well. You lose, you not only lose the poetry, but you lose Melville, and he just becomes a sort of a mechanical versifier.
I think we just got a little luxury without having to pay the tuition.
Well, I don't mean to turn this into yet another seminar. No.
Well, you're also conducting workshops?
That is the one I conduct. Well, it's called verse composition. Mm-hmm. But I teach one other course, which is a reading course, which is modern poetry in English. The first half of the, usually, as it turns out, the first half of the year is American poetry since Emily Dickinson and Whitman.
Are you in a position?
And the last one is British poetry since about the time of Hardy. Or sometimes I teach the British one first and the Americans one second.
Well, are you in a position of working with your students with their own poetry?
Yeah, sure. That's what the workshop class is all about, and some very good people have been through it. One of my better students was Pat Conroy, who did The Great Santini, the novel which the movie was written, and Lords of Discipline, and another quite good book called The Water is Wide, which was made into a film and directed by, who's the guy that does those, the book, the little thing with Sally Fields about the cotton mills.
I know what you're talking about.
Pat's novel was called The Water is Wide. And it was the film was called Conrack, but anyway, he was a member of the class, and he started out writing poetry. And I remember telling him that he didn't seem to have the gift of phrase for poetry, that the crystallization of a thought in original language it was not his strong suit. What he was good at was developing situations between people. Especially if they involved conflict of some sort, and that he should work out with prose fiction, mm-hmm. And he did, and he just went to town with it.
Allison Lurie was here last week, and she teaches at Cornell, and she finds that her students, she says she is now the radical guru, right. You use that term in her own class. Whereas at one point back in the 60s, she felt conservative, that students were much more radical. And she finds that many of the students who wish to be writers aren't taking chances. They're not being adventuresome in their writing. Have you noticed this at all?
Yes, I do. A lot of them are looking for a formula, and that consequently they are very imitative of two classes of writers, either older or their age and more advanced than they are at the time. One class of writer who's already done something that's been successful in some way, they want to imitate. The other class are the ones that are currently fashionable among their set. You know, they want to imitate them. But the really good ones don't want to imitate anybody. So consequently, if they are really good, if the other ones they set the trend and the other ones fall in behind them. I think W. H. Auden once said that a poet he was the editor of the Yale series of younger poets for several years, and he was an outstanding editor too. He discovered some very fine young people who had first books in the Yale series under his editorship, and he wrote introductions for each of them. And he said, I remember there was one very good young fellow, young at the time, named Robert Horan, who just had that one book, was wonderfully talented. And Auden says about him, he says, when a young poet's first book comes out, or the manuscript comes in, what you look for are two things. One of them is technical facility. If he has had enough love of his medium to have acquired relatively early some technical facility, and the book displays this. The second one is his own vision of things. It says one can acquire the first, one can learn the techniques of verse composition, which is what I try to teach, but the other one is probably something that the writer has to be born with. His own vision, his own odd slant on experience and so on. There are some writers who have this to an outstanding degree. Dylan Thomas is the main one that I can think of in my time who had it. I mean, he not only had a very original vision of existence, but he had a wonderful instrument, verse instrument, to render it that sounded like no one else. You notice you never see any imitations of Dylan Thomas, because the imitations of him either sound like very bad Thomas, or they are so inept and so trying for it and would be that they become a parody of Thomas. So he has had no progeny, literary progeny. He's an absolute, almost an absolute original. Now you take a writer like Auden, whom everybody imitates. He's given the poets that came after him a very serviceable style and an instrument that they can adapt to their uses, so that a lot of people can sound, they're not as good as Auden, but a lot of people can sound like him and still be very good. The same thing is true of a poet like Wallace Stevens, who is inimitable and fastidious and imaginative and so on, but has almost nothing as subject matter. I mean, if you have Wallace Stevens' approach to poetry, you can write poetry about anything. And that's what so many of his imitators do, and that's why it's so thin and attenuated, because it doesn't have Wallace Stevens' philosophical depth behind it. It just has this business of poetry, of the poet writing poetry about writing poetry about writing poetry about writing poetry, and so on. It's sort of a succession of infinite regress, kind of, you know.
Hall of Mirrors.
Yeah, right.
Jim Stickey, of course, you are not only a poet, you are also a prose writer. You've written scores of essays and one novel. And you have been working on a new novel for some years. Have you put that on the back burner?
No, I'm just about to finish it. It's about blind men and airplanes.
Yeah, that's right.
It was. I've been working on it for 34 years.
Yeah.
And I've tried it out so many different ways. I mean, again, it was not like Deliverance at all, which I knew the whole plot almost from the beginning, and I never varied from that. This one is, I work on much more as I would work on poetry, trying it different ways and eliminating one thing in favor of something that's better until it's sort of refined down into something irreducible. This is the only way I ever know when I finish a poem. I remember the French poet Paul Valéry said once, one never finishes a poem, one abandons it.
That's right.
But I don't think you should abandon it without a long and honorable fight to help it realize its intentions.
Robert Lowell had to die to abandon his.
Yeah, well, most of them do have to die, and I too in my time.
You have been doing some screenwriting.
Well, I did some. Yes, I did the screenplay for Deliverance.
We were working on a screenplay earlier this year.
I don't think I'm going to finish that one, though. I didn't like it much. I did, several years ago, one for NBC. Is it right to mention that on here?
Sure.
You don't see me as... I did Jack London's Call of the Wild for NBC about 5 or 6 years ago.
I remember that. I didn't realize you really...
Yeah, it was very good, too. I saw it again on television.
I saw that. I would have paid more attention had I known.
Well, now, it keeps coming back, so you can see it again.
You are in New York. You're going to, I understand, deliver a tribute to Truman Capote.
Yeah, so at the National Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters tomorrow night. And I'm going to do that. Try to get my judgment down among the others.
This seemed to be a very poignant and very a sad death at his tribute, which was sponsored by Random House at a major theater in New York. One of the, I think it was his agent, got up and quoted a line from someone else, but it seemed very apt in Truman Capote's death. He said that... He quoted the medical examiner's autopsy and said, no, he didn't die of that. He said, Truman Capote died of everything.
Yeah, well, if you knew him, you'd be likely to agree with that. But the newspapers were rather unkind to him, I thought. And a lot of people didn't like him, and I think they were in some ways envious of him.
Did you know Capote?
I knew him somewhat. But not very well. No, he began to come to the front when I was in college. He was as precocious. He and I are about the same age. I think maybe he's a year younger than I am. But he was, my goodness, I was struggling around and trying to get a college degree, and here this guy my age was a rage of the literary world. He then became the rage of the social world, and so on.
That did not help him.
No, well, I don't know, you know, what it did for him, but when he published those four excerpts from that unfinished novel, Answered Prayers, everybody jumped on him, you know. And
well, it's kind of a scandal. He kept talking about working on his manuscript of Answered Prayers, and nobody's been able to find it.
I don't think it exists. This is my personal opinion. I don't have any actual information to that effect. But
that's what everybody says, they can't find it.
I don't think it exists, no.
He was fooling people, and fooling himself probably for many years. He was deeply involved in taking drugs and alcohol. And
well, all that. But I mean, that's such a usual thing. The drugs have come in more or less recently in the last 20, 25 years, but the American writer has never been any stranger to alcohol. Look at Hemingway, or look at Faulkner. He would be open to a good case.
Well, I've heard this. I've heard this from more people than yourself, that there seems to be a heavy amount of drinking among writers, but I don't know if there's any way to show that there's more drinking among writers than there would be among advertisers.
There's not, except that it's more in the public. I mean, there's a lot of people that took a lot more drugs than Truman Capote took, if you're Truman Capote or John Belushi or somebody like that that people know about, they say, oh God, the guy ran himself on drugs. I'm sure it didn't do him any good. And so on, but it's a focus on those people at the exclusion of everybody else is not quite right. I mean, it's not their fault any more than it is anybody else's fault, and they've suffered plenty from it. I'm sure they did. And Capote was not a real strong person physically anyway. I'm sure destined to be sick a lot, you know, without running his system down with all these foreign substances as well. I'm surprised he lived as long as he did.
Gosh, you told me the last time you were here that you were known for putting down quite a few drinks yourself.
Yeah, I could hold it with any of them, I think. But there comes a point of the diminishing returns, and you see your output is not only falling off some, but it's not as sharp as you want it. So it's like Hemingway says, you've got to go into the mountains like a prize fighter and work the fat off your soul. You've got to keep the instrument sharp. You've got to keep your left hook stinging, you know.
Are you still hunting?
Well, not much. I haven't in 7 years. Speaking of going up into the mountains, I aspire to it before I get too decrepit and senile to do any more of it, but I haven't, to answer your question, I haven't done much lately, no.
Your last major book, I think, was Puella, although you have reworked a lot of the original poems that you had written many years ago into a couple of new volumes, I understand.
No, I haven't reworked them. I've just reprinted
them. Reprinted them, yes. That's what I meant. Well, you have reworked them. You reorganized them in different sequences.
Not really. The last big book I had was one called The Central Motion, and all I did was take four books and print them in the sequence in which we were originally published, one after the other, and under a single set of covers. But no, I didn't change the order around at all. They're published in the order, or presented in the order of publication.
Well, yeah, I know you had, I have it at home, you have a book of, I can't remember the title, I should have written it down when I came here today, but as I did buy it, it was the new book of essays that you had written.
Night Herdling.
Yeah, Night Herdling.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, well, a lot of those are fairly old, but some of them are fairly new. I mean, a book like that, which is kind of a grab bag, is you hope that it'll have something for everybody, and that's got... It's got essays, it's got literary criticism, it's got poems, it's got some translations in it, and some personal essays, or what used to be called familiar essays, and social commentary, and lots of stuff.
Can we expect a new book of poetry from you in the near future?
Maybe in a year. Yeah, I have two of them that I'm working on. One of them is a sequence of poems about engineless flight called Peace Raids. And the other one I have an actual children's book finished, and it'll be out this time next year. That's done. Peace Raids is about half done, and then I have another sort of a collection of, what would you say, occasional poems called Real God Roll.
Well, we'll be looking forward to those books when they come out.
I got to write them first.
Finish them up. And, of course, we're going to wait for the novel. Bill Hayen is a younger poet. I guess he's not young anymore. I guess he's in his early 40s. But Bill went to my alma mater, and so he was here a while ago. And
what's your alma mater?
Ohio University. We chatted on the phone, I think, when you called to set up the time for our chat, that you had known Walter Tevis and a few of the people there.
Hollis Summers,
who was my creative writing professor in 1956.
But it was very good, too.
He was, of course, he wouldn't remember me. I was there as skinny kid with the crew cut, and I wrote very badly, but I remember him because he was extremely gentle when he would critique your work. He would write something on it, "This pleases me," or if he didn't like it, he would write, "I can't hear."
All right, I'm going to tap that to my own. Jack Matthews is also there.
Yes, in fact, last March, I threw a little reading, because they were from Ohio University, I threw a little reading, and Matthews was in to read from his new book, published by Houghton Mifflin.
I gave him a jacket quilt for that.
Yes, that's right. He was very pleased.
I was pleased with what he wrote. I really was. He's good.
Yes, he is. And so he came in and gave a little reading, and so did Walter Tevis. And I didn't know Walter at the time was as sick as he was.
Oh, man, that was terrible.
But Bill is a big collector of poetry, and the nice thing about poetry is that, contrary to the people who collect novels,
right.
They're so thin. And he has around 5,000 to 10,000 books of poetry, almost all signed.
Yeah, he sends all of mine down to be signed. I always do it. Yeah.
Well, what he's done, he's taken all of these books and he has donated them, or he has, donated is the wrong word, he has placed them in a rare book room, the William Hayen Room.
Wonderful.
At the University of Buffalo.
Wonderful, yeah. As a matter of fact, speaking of night hurdling, one of the interviews in there is by Bill Hayen. He was doing what you were doing. And when I was at, Brockport?
Brockport, yes. That's where he teaches.
James
Dickey, I appreciate you coming in and giving us an update on some of the things you've been doing and some of your thoughts. And,
sure.
I don't know if we covered everything that you wanted to cover. There may be some more things.
No, that's fine with me.
You can breathe a sigh of relief now.
I don't know anything else.
But I hope that we'll be able to do this again every so often. Periodically, my writers keep coming back year after year, and we chat about new things and get caught up to date, and broadcast runs every day of the, here in New York, it runs 7 days a week, in fact. As long as it holds up, I want to keep doing people like yourself. And it started out kind of shakily, because I didn't have, it's now almost completely literary in its thrust, but when I remember my first week, the very first week it went on the air on a full-time basis, this has been running for many years, but on a full-time Monday through Friday basis, I did a three-part profile of William Styron and a two-part series on a book called The Better Way to Drink.
There's a
combination. And now I don't have to do those nonfiction books anymore.
Better Way to Drink.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.